Imagine inheriting a $30 million fortune from your late spouse, only to lose like half of it to the IRS years later simply because your accountant forgot to file a single completely blank piece of paper. You thought you were safe, you definitely weren't. Today we are looking at the hidden traps, the phantom incomes, and the invisible tripwires buried deep inside the U.S. tax code. But first, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 65 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted exactly like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Okay, let's just jump right into it. We are conquering the tax consideration section of the Series 65 exam.
Which I know on paper sounds like the absolute fastest way to put someone into a deep, irreversible sleep. It is worth about 3 to 4 questions, which is roughly 2% of your exam. But here's the critical reality that you really need to grasp. Tax law is highly applicable to almost every single other topic you are going to study, right from portfolio management all the way to retirement planning.
Yeah, I know tax law can be super dry. It can feel like you're just, I don't know, memorizing a phone book of percentages and penalties. So for you listening right now, we are throwing out the textbook today. No dry lectures. We are going to visualize these rules. To do that, we have created a cast of characters to help us navigate this madness. Let me introduce you to the crew. First, we have founder Frank. Frank is this ambitious, highly caffeinated, but slightly overwhelmed entrepreneur who is, you know, trying to build a business empire out of his garage.
Right, a classic client profile. He is going to help us understand entity taxation, specifically the brutal realities of double taxation and, well, why corporate structures actually matter so much.
Next up, we have Careless Carl. Carl is a well-meaning guy, but he constantly trips over deadlines. He clicks the wrong buttons in his brokerage account, he panic sells at the absolute worst times, and he basically triggers every single tax penalty the IRS has ever invented.
We all have a client exactly like Carl. I mean, he is going to be our guide through the treacherous waters of capital losses, wash sales, and missed distributions.
And finally, we have Wealthy Wendy. She is Careless Carl's incredibly rich aunt. She has a massive estate, she vacations in Monaco, and she is basically trying to navigate complex wealth transfers without giving her entire fortune to the federal government.
She will be our lens for estate taxes, trusts, and those high-income surtaxes. And if we look at the overarching mission of this deep dive, this is exactly why the exam tests this material so heavily. Because as an investment advisor, your fiduciary duty demands that you look at the after-tax reality of your client's wealth. I mean, you could recommend an investment that generates a spectacular gross return, but if that recommendation triggers a massive tax bomb, your client's net return is completely destroyed. You haven't helped them, you've actively harmed them.
Exactly. Fiduciary duty means the net number is the only number that matters. So before we can even talk about Wendy's massive wealth or Frank's business structures, we have to establish the baseline. We need to understand how every day ordinary income is taxed in the United States. That brings us to Section 1, which is individual income tax in brackets.
The absolute foundation of it all. The United States uses a progressive tax system. We currently have 7 federal tax brackets for ordinary income, ranging from 10% at the bottom to 37% at the top. But the fundamental concept candidates absolutely must grasp is the difference between a marginal tax rate and an effective tax rate.
Okay, here is an analogy I absolutely love for this. I call it the water buckets. So imagine your annual income is a continuous stream of water, and these 7 tax brackets are a series of literal buckets stacked on top of each other. The very first bucket at the bottom is the 10% bucket. As your income starts flowing on January 1st, it fills that 10% bucket first. The IRS takes 10% of the water inside that specific bucket. Once that first bucket is completely full, the water spills over into the next bucket up, which is the 12% bucket. The IRS takes 12% of the water in that second bucket, and it just keeps spilling up and up into the 22% bucket, the 24% bucket, and so on, depending on how much you earn.
That visualization perfectly captures the mechanics of a progressive system. The marginal rate is simply the tax rate applied to the last highest dollar of income you earn. It is the top bucket your water stream managed to reach. Your effective rate, however, is the blended average of all those buckets combined.
Okay, I want you, the listener, to think about this directly. I am pausing here. If Wealthy Wendy has so much income this year that she lands in the 32% tax bracket, does she pay 32% on all of her income? Think about it for a second.
The answer is definitively no.
Right. And if you see this on the test, red flags should go up everywhere in your mind. The test writers will absolutely try to trick you into applying that marginal rate, the top bracket, to the total gross income.
Precisely. They do it all the time. Wendy only pays 32% on the specific dollars of income that spilled into that 32% bucket. The income she earned earlier in the year filled the 10%, 12%, 22%, and 24% buckets. And those earlier dollars are still taxed at those corresponding lower rates. Therefore, her effective tax rate, like the actual real world percentage of her total income going to the IRS, will always be significantly lower than her 32% marginal rate.
Because it's a blended average. Okay, so we have the foundation for ordinary income. But what about dividends? When Wendy buys stock in a massive blue chip company and they pay her a quarterly dividend, how does that fit into the water buckets?
Well, this is where we introduce the critical distinction between qualified dividends and ordinary dividends. The legislative intent of Congress here is important to understand. They want to reward long-term investment in the economy. So if a dividend meets the criteria to be qualified, it escapes those ordinary income buckets entirely. Instead, it gets taxed at preferential rates. Those are 0%, 15%, or 20%, depending on your overall income level.
Wow, that's a massive discount. So how does a dividend actually earn that qualified status?
There are two main hurdles. First, the dividend must be paid by a U.S. corporation or a qualified foreign corporation. Second, and this is heavily tested, there is a strict holding period requirement. The stockholder must hold the underlying stock for more than 60 days during a specific 121-day period that begins 60 days before the ex-dividend date.
Wait, what? That sounds like a terrifying math word problem. More than 60 days in a 121-day period. Why on earth did the IRS design such a bizarrely specific window?
I know, it sounds ridiculous, but they designed it to prevent a very specific type of tax arbitrage. They want to make sure Careless Carl isn't simply day trading a stock just to capture the dividend on Tuesday, dumping the stock on Wednesday, and still claiming a preferential tax rate on that income. The government is essentially saying, look, we will give you a tax break, but you have to prove you are actually an investor, not just a momentary speculator.
Got it. So if Carl buys a stock, collects a dividend and sells the stock 3 days later, he completely fails the holding period. Mm-hmm. That dividend is non-qualified. It is treated as ordinary income and gets thrown right back into his regular tax buckets, potentially taxed up to 37% if his income is high enough.
Exactly. It's a costly mistake. The holding period is absolute. Now, there's another nuance regarding dividends that candidates must be hyper aware of. Certain types of investments generate dividends that are inherently ordinary income, regardless of how long you hold them.
Okay, I am looking right at real estate investment trusts, or REITs. If you see REITs on the exam, be very, very careful.
Whoa, it's a classic distractor.
But let me push back on this because it feels totally counterintuitive. REITs own massive skyscrapers. They own shopping malls, data centers. They trade on the major stock exchanges right alongside Apple and Microsoft. Why wouldn't their dividends be qualified like any other normal corporation?
The answer lies in the underlying entity structure, which reveals the why behind the rule. A REIT does not pay corporate-level income tax, provided it distributes at least 90% of its taxable income directly to its shareholders. Because the REIT itself is skipping the corporate tax layer, the IRS insists on getting its full pound of flesh at the shareholder level. The government never lets money go completely untaxed. So because there was no corporate tax paid, REIT dividends do not get the preferential 0, 15, or 20% rates. They are taxed as ordinary income at the investor's top marginal bracket.
Man. So if Careless Carl buys a REIT, holds it for 5 years, and thinks he's getting a sweet 15% qualified dividend rate, he is going to have a very tough conversation with his accountant in April.
An incredibly tough conversation. If a test question asks you to identify which dividend is taxed as ordinary income, regardless of the holding period, your eyes should immediately scan the options for a REIT.
Okay, so we know how regular income and dividends are taxed. But what happens when our characters actually start trading the underlying stocks themselves? Let's transition into Section 2. Capital gains, losses, and Careless Carl's mistakes.
This brings us to the mechanics of capital gains. We aren't going to spend time defining a basic capital gain, you know? It's selling an asset for more than its adjusted cost basis. What we need to explore is the nuanced way the IRS treats different types of gains. Because just like with dividends, the tax code heavily favors patience.
Right, the great divide, short-term versus long-term. Let's say Careless Carl buys a highly volatile meme stock. It spikes, and he sells it exactly 6 months later for a massive profit.
because he held it for 1 year or less, that is a short-term capital gain. The IRS treats that exactly the same as his W-2 salary. It pours straight into those ordinary income water buckets we talked about, taxed at rates up to 37%.
Correct. But if wealthy Wendy buys a stock and holds it for 1 year and 1 day or anything longer than that, it transforms into a long-term capital gain. Suddenly, she unlocks those preferential rates of 0, 15, or 20%.
1 year plus 1 day. Literally, waiting a single 24-hour period drops your tax rate from potentially 37% down to 20%. That is a staggering difference in real retainable wealth. But Wendy is extraordinarily wealthy. Her income is completely off the charts. Doesn't the federal government have a special surcharge waiting just for her?
They absolutely do. It is called the Net Investment Income Tax, or NIIT. This is an additional 3.8% surtax levied specifically on investment income. It kicks in when an individual's modified adjusted gross income, or MAGI, crosses a specific statutory threshold.
Wait, unpack that term for a second. We hear AGI all the time. Yeah. What makes it modified adjusted gross income?
It's an excellent question. To get MAGI, you take your standard adjusted gross income and add back certain deductions that the IRS considers overly generous for high earners. For instance, if you have tax-exempt foreign earned income or certain deductions for student loan interest, the IRS adds those back into your AGI to create your MAGI. It is essentially a stricter measure of your true economic income. For the NIT, the MAGI threshold is $200,000 for a single filer and $250,000 for a married couple filing jointly.
So Wendy easily blasts through that $200,000 threshold.
Yeah.
What does that 3.8% surcharge actually mean for her preferential long-term rate?
Well, it means we stack the taxes. Assuming Wendy is in the highest income tier, her base long-term capital gains rate is 20%. But because her MAGI is so high, every dollar of investment income also gets hit with a 3.8% NIIT. Therefore, her long-term capital gains are effectively taxed at 23.8%.
23.8%. I mean, that is still significantly better than 37% plus 3.8%, but it is definitely a noticeable bite out of her returns. And that's what happens when things go well. But we need to talk about careless Carl. Carl decides he is a market genius. He quits his job to become a full-time day trader. He buys high. He panic sells low. By December 31st, Carl has realized $100,000 in pure capital losses. He calls you, his advisor, and says, well, it was a rough year, but at least I could deduct all of this $100,000 from my taxes and get a massive refund check to start over.
And this is exactly where you, as the advisor, have to deliver the bad news.
Yeah, because I am looking at the rule book, and it clearly states you can only deduct $3,000 a year. Are you telling me that if Carl loses $100,000, he can only write off $3,000 this year? It is literally going to take him 33 years to write off his losses. How is that not a complete scam by the IRS?
Hold on, let's clarify the mechanics here, because candidates consistently misinterpret this exact rule. The fundamental rule is that capital losses offset capital gains dollar for dollar with absolutely zero limit.
Oh, so if Carl had also miraculously made $100,000 in capital gains on a few lucky trades, he could use his $100,000 in losses to wipe those gains out completely.
Precisely. The two columns net out against each other infinitely. The heavily tested $3,000 limit only comes into play when you have net capital losses left over after wiping out all your gains, and you are attempting to use those leftover losses to offset your ordinary income, like your salary or your interest income.
Okay, this is exactly where candidates lose points. The $3,000 limit is exclusively for offsetting ordinary income. So if Carl has $100,000 in losses and zero gains, he can deduct $3,000 against his salary this year. But what happens to the remaining $97,000? Does it just, like, vanish into the ether?
No, the IRS allows unused net capital losses to carry forward indefinitely. Next year, Carl starts with $97,000 locked and loaded in the loss column. If he generates gains next year, he uses that carry forward to offset them. If he still has no gains, he takes another $3,000 deduction against his salary, carrying $94,000 into the following year. It rolls forward perpetually until he either uses it up or passes away.
Okay, so the IRS isn't entirely malicious. They just refuse to let you wipe out your entire W-2 salary with terrible stock market gambles in a single calendar year. Now, speaking of terrible gambles, listener, if you are multitasking or checking your phone, come back to me. Listen to my voice right now. Careless Carl makes this next mistake every single year, and it absolutely will be on your exam. We are talking about the wash sale rule.
Ah, yes, the quintessential behavioral finance trap meeting a strict tax penalty.
Here is the scenario. It is Monday morning. Carl owns 1,000 shares of XYZ Corp. He bought them for $50 a share. The market opens, and the stock plummets to $20 a share. He is absolutely devastated. He logs into his brokerage account and sells all the shares on Monday, realizing a massive $30,000 capital loss.
Yeah.
Consoles himself by thinking, okay, well, at least I locked in my tax write-off. But then, on Wednesday, just 48 hours later, he reads an analyst report claiming XYZ is fundamentally sound and is about to rebound aggressively. He panics. He logs back in and buys 1,000 shares of the exact same XYZ Corp back on Wednesday at $20.
And by clicking that buy button, he has just triggered a wash sale. Yeah. The IRS regulation states that if you sell a security at a loss and you purchase a substantially identical security within 30 days before or after the sale date, the loss you just realized is entirely disallowed.
Disallowed. The IRS looks at Carl's brokerage statement and says, nice try, pal. You didn't actually exit your economic position. You just sold it to harvest a phantom tax loss and immediately bought your position back. The 30 days before or 30 days after is the critical window. It's actually a 61-day total window if you count the exact day of the sale. But here is the critical question. The exam will give you this exact scenario and ask, what happens to that disallowed loss? Is it permanently erased?
It is not permanently erased, and understanding this mechanic is vital. The disallowed loss is mathematically added to the cost basis of the new replacement shares he just purchased.
Let's walk through that math on a legal pad for the client. So Carl bought originally at $50, sold at $20. He has a $30 loss per share. He buys back in 2 days later at $20. The IRS denies the $30 loss, but they take that $30 and staple it to his new $20 purchase price. So what is his new adjusted cost basis for tax purposes?
His new cost basis is $50 per share. It is the $20 he just paid in cash, plus the $30 disallowed loss from the previous trade. What this fundamentally means is that the wash sale rule does not delete the loss. It simply defers the loss until Carl eventually sells those new replacement shares in a clean transaction without triggering another wash sale.
Deferred, not deleted. Wash sale equals deferred loss added to the new basis. That is a perfect transition to Section 3, the sneaky surtaxes and surcharges. Because ordinary brackets and capital gains rates aren't enough for the federal government. If you have too many deductions or if you have a massive income spike in retirement, the government has built secret parallel systems waiting to catch you. Let's start with the AMT, the alternative minimum tax.
The AMT is essentially a shadow tax code. To understand why it exists, you have to look at the legislative history. Decades ago, Congress realized that a handful of ultra-wealthy individuals were utilizing massive amounts of completely legal deductions, credits, and loopholes to reduce their federal tax liability to literally zero. The AMT was created as a backstop to ensure that high earners paid at least some baseline level of tax, regardless of how clever their accountants were.
Right, because without the AMT, wealthy Wendy could theoretically hire a skyscraper full of tax attorneys, claim millions in obscure deductions, and end up paying less federal tax than the guy delivering her Amazon packages. How does this shadow system actually function in practice?
It forces a dual-track calculation. Come April, Wendy's accountant must calculate her taxes under the regular standard rules. Then they must calculate her taxes a second time under the completely separate AMT rules. The AMT rules say, look, we refuse to acknowledge many of your standard deductions. We are forcing you to add them back into your income. This newly inflated number is called her alternative minimum taxable income, or AMTI.
And then they apply the specific AMT tax brackets, which are currently 26% and 28%.
Correct. And here is the brutal kicker. Wendy must look at the final number from the regular calculation and the final number from the AMT calculation, and she is legally required to pay whichever number is higher.
The house always wins. Listener, you do not need to memorize the incredibly complex spreadsheet math of calculating AMPI, but you absolutely must know what specific items trigger the AMT in the first place. The exam will ask you to identify tax preference items, the things that get added back into your income under the shadow system. What are the big ones?
There are two major triggers that candidates will see. The first is incentive stock options, or ISOs.
Okay, walk us through the ISO trap, because a lot of tech employees get completely blindsided by this.
Let's say you work for a pre-IPO tech startup. You are granted ISOs with a strike price of $10. Years later, the company is wildly successful, and the stock is trading on the open market at $110. You decide to exercise your options, meaning you buy the shares at your $10 strike price. You now own shares worth $110, but you only paid $10. That $100 difference is called the spread.
But you haven't sold the shares yet. You just bought them and are holding them in your account. You haven't made any actual cash profit.
Exactly. Under the regular tax system, exercising and holding an ISO is not a taxable event. You don't owe tax until you eventually sell the stock. But under the AMT Shatter system, the IRS looks at that $100 spread and says, that is phantom wealth. We consider that a tax preference item. That $100 spread per share is added directly into your alternative minimum taxable income.
That is horrific. You exercise options, you hold the stock believing in the company, you receive zero cash, and suddenly you owe the IRS a massive shadow tax bill based purely on paper wealth. What is the second major AMT trigger?
Private activity municipal bonds.
Wait, pause. Municipal bonds. I thought the entire defining characteristic of a municipal bond was that the interest payments are completely tax exempt at the federal level.
They are under the regular tax system, but we have to differentiate between a general obligation muni bond, which funds public works like schools and roads, and a private activity municipal bond. A private activity bond is issued by a local government, but the funds are used to build a project that heavily benefits a private corporation, like a new stadium for a billionaire sports team, or a privately operated airport terminal. Because the bond benefits private interests, Congress declared the interest on these specific bonds to be a tax preference item.
So the interest is tax-free on your normal return, but it gets added back as taxable income on your AMT return. So, if a test question asks which of the following investments could trigger the alternative minimum tax, you are scanning for private activity municipal bonds. Do not get tricked by regular muni bonds.
Vital distinction, yes.
Let's talk about the other sneaky surcharge, and this one is arguably more dangerous because it catches retirees off guard. IRMAA, the income-related monthly adjustment amount. This revolves around Medicare. So Wendy is 68 years old, and she is enrolled in Medicare. Listener, I am asking you directly. Think about this. If Wendy's financial advisor recommends she do a massive multi-million dollar Roth conversion this year, which causes her taxable income to absolutely skyrocket, when does she actually feel the financial pain of higher Medicare premiums? Take a second.
This is a classic behavioral and planning trap. The answer is not this calendar year, and it is not next calendar year. The pain hits in exactly 2 years.
The two-year look back. Explain the mechanics behind this delay.
IRAAA is a surcharge levied on Medicare Part B and Part D premiums for high-income beneficiaries. For 2026, the threshold is $109,000 for a single person and $218,000 for a married couple. If your modified adjusted gross income goes even $1 above those thresholds, your Medicare premiums jump significantly. But think about the logistics. The Social Security Administration, which manages Medicare, does not know your real-time current year income. They only have access to your finalized tax returns from the IRS.
And tax returns are filed a year late.
Exactly. So they institute a strict two-year look-back period.
Okay, let's map this out. A massive Roth conversion in 2024 artificially spikes Wendy's MAGI in 2024. But the government doesn't process that finalized tax data immediately. They use her 2024 tax return to calculate and dictate her Medicare premium surcharges for the year 2026.
Precisely. Because of the two-year look back, the most dangerous age for tax planning isn't 65, it's 63. If you don't execute your major taxable events or Roth conversions by age 62, the income generated at age 63 will trigger the IRMAA trap the very year you enroll in Medicare at 65. If an advisor recommends a massive capital gain realization without forecasting the IRMAA look-back, that client is going to receive a very angry letter from the government 2 years later, and they're going to blame the advisor.
You have to play chess, not checkers. All right, moving into Section 4, Retirement Distributions and the Ticking Clock. Wealthy Wendy and Careless Carl are getting older. They have had their wealth growing tax-deferred in traditional IRAs and 401ks for decades. But the IRS does not allow you to shield that money forever. Eventually, the ticking clock stops, and the government demands its cut.
This introduces required minimum distributions, or RMDs. The government forces you to begin liquidating a specific percentage of your tax-deferred accounts at a statutory age, ensuring that the money is finally recognized and taxed as ordinary income.
I feel like Congress changes the RMD age every time I blink. It was 70 and a half forever, then they bumped it to 72. Where did the Secure Act 2.0 actually leave us for the current exam cycle?
They have created a tiered system based on birth year. Currently, if you were born between 1951 and 1959, your RMD age is 73. If you were born in 1960 or later, your RMD age is pushed back to 75.
Let's use Carl as an example. Let's say Carl's born in 1952. He turned 73 this calendar year. What is the absolute deadline for him to take that very first distribution?
Well, the IRS gives you a slight grace period for the very first one. You have until April 1st of the year following the year you turn the required age. So if Carl turns 73 this year, he must execute his first RMD by April 1st of next year. Every subsequent year, the deadline is simply December 31st.
But we know careless Carl. He's probably distracted by trying to execute a watch sale on a penny stock. April 1st comes and goes, and he hasn't withdrawn a single dime from his traditional IRA. What is the penalty?
It remains one of the most punitive penalties in the entire U.S. tax code. The penalty for failing to take an RMD is a 25% excise tax on the exact dollar amount he should have withdrawn.
Or 25%. Let's contextualize that. If his required withdrawal was calculated at $100,000, he just owes the IRS a $25,000 check purely as a penalty. And worse, he still has to take the money out and pay the regular ordinary income tax on the $100,000 anyway.
It is a devastating double hit. Now, Congress did soften the blow slightly in recent years. If Carl recognizes his error and corrects the missed distribution within a specific two-year correction window, that 25% penalty is reduced to 10%. But a 10% penalty on a mandatory withdrawal is still an agonizing unforced error.
Okay, now we need to do a side-by-side comparison. We just outlined the strict rules for traditional IRAs. What about Roth IRAs?
Mm-hmm.
If Wendy has built a massive multi-million dollar Roth IRA, is she forced to start draining it at 73 or 75?
Absolutely not. This highlights one of the most powerful structural advantages of a Roth IRA. During the original account owner's lifetime, there are zero required minimum distributions. None. Wendy can let that money sit, compound, and grow completely tax-free until the moment she passes away.
Listener, write this down and put a star next to it. Traditional IRA equals YES Maget lifetime RMDs.
Yeah.
Roth IRA for the original owner equals NO lifetime RMDs. And emphasize this next part, because the exam writers use this specific scenario to trap candidates who are moving too fast, what happens when Wendy dies, and careless Carl inherits her Roth IRA.
The moment the account transfers to a beneficiary, the rules invert. Inherited Roth IRAs do have strict distribution requirements. While the exact timeline depends on the beneficiary's classification, whether they are an eligible designated beneficiary or not, most non-spouse beneficiaries, like Carl, are subject to the 10-year rule. He must completely empty the entire inherited Roth IRA by the end of the 10th year following Wendy's death. The distributions he takes will be tax-free, assuming Wendy met the original 5-year aging rule, but Carl cannot simply leave the money to compound indefinitely like Wendy did.
Right. Traditional equals RMDs. Roth equals no lifetime RMDs. Inherited Roth equals mandatory distributions. You must distinguish between the original owner and the beneficiary. Okay, let's reset our brains. We've covered individual brackets, capital gains mechanics, shadow taxes, and retirement timelines. Let's shift gears entirely and dive into Section 5, Entity Taxation. Enter founder Frank.
Yes, Frank is our proxy for the business owner. When you advise an entrepreneur or when you analyze a business as an investment, the structural choice of the entity dictates entirely how the revenue flows and, more importantly, at what level the government taxes that revenue.
So let's give Frank a real scenario. Frank starts his company, Frank's Fantastic Widgets. He incorporates immediately as a standard C corporation. What is the defining tax feature of his new C-Corp?
The defining feature and the core concept tested relentlessly is double taxation. In the eyes of the law and the IRS, a C-Corporation is a completely separate, standalone legal entity. It is an artificial person.
Walk us through the exact math of double taxation. Let's say Frank C-Corp generates exactly $1 million in net taxable profit this year.
Step one. The corporation itself must pay a flat 21% federal corporate income tax on that profit. The corporation cuts a check to the IRS for $210,000. The C-Corp now has $790,000 of after-tax profit remaining in its accounts.
Got it. Step two. Frank decides he wants to buy a vacation home. So he distributes that remaining $790,000 out to himself as a shareholder dividend.
And here the trap snaps shut. Frank receives that $790,000 dividend. He must report that exact amount on his personal, individual 1040 tax return. Assuming it meets the holding period we discussed earlier, he will pay qualified dividend taxes, let's say 20% on that money. The same pool of economic profit was taxed once at the corporate level and a second time at the individual shareholder level. To make matters worse, the corporation is absolutely forbidden from deducting those dividend payments. Dividends are paid out of after-tax corporate profit.
Wow. So Frank does the math and realizes he is bleeding capital to the IRS. He calls his accountant, furious, and demands, "Stop the double taxation. I don't want the company paying taxes." The accountant files the paperwork to convert the company into an S corporation. How does this structural shift solve Frank's problem?
Well, an S corporation is a pass-through entity. The S corp itself generally pays zero federal income tax at the corporate level. The $1 million in net profit essentially bypasses the corporate tax layer entirely. The profit passes through the entity and flows directly onto Frank's personal tax return, documented on a form called a Schedule K-1.
Boom, single taxation. Frank simply pays his individual ordinary income tax rate on the business's profit, and the IRS is satisfied. But wait, if pass-through taxation is so vastly superior, why doesn't every massive publicly traded conglomerate in the world operate as an S-corp? Why isn't Amazon an S-corp?
Because the pass-through advantage is an intentional legislative subsidy for small businesses, not Wall Street behemoths. To prevent massive corporations from exploiting it, Congress placed very strict, highly testable limitations on exactly who can qualify for S-corp status.
Okay, let's list the limitations. If you see S-corp on the exam, you need to verify these rules.
First limitation, an S-corp is restricted to a maximum of 100 shareholders. Amazon has millions of shareholders, so they are immediately disqualified. Second, all shareholders must be individual U.S. citizens or resident aliens. You cannot have foreign investors, and you generally cannot have other corporations as shareholders. Third, an S-corp is only allowed to issue one single class of stock. You can issue voting and non-voting shares, but you cannot create complex capital structures with preferred stock and common stock.
Okay, maximum 100, U.S. residents only, one class of stock. But what if Frank didn't want to deal with corporate formalities at all? What if he just set up a partnership with Careless Carl or an LLC?
From a pure taxation standpoint, the result is remarkably similar. Partnerships and standard LLCs are also pass-through entities. The business itself pays no entity-level tax. All profits, losses, deductions, and credits flow through via a Schedule K-1, and the individual partners pay the tax at their own personal rates based on their ownership percentage.
So C-Corp suffer double tax. S-Corp, LLCs, and partnerships enjoy pass-through single tax. Now, let's briefly return to two unique public entities we mentioned earlier, REITs and MLPs. We already established that REITs escape corporate tax by distributing 90% of their income, which forces the dividend to be taxed as ordinary income for the investor. But what about MLPs, Master Limited Partnerships? These trade publicly, usually in the energy pipeline sector.
MLPs are unique because they offer pass-through taxation while being publicly traded. But the specific tax feature candidates need to recognize is how their distributions are categorized. Often, a large portion of the cash distribution an investor receives from an MLP is classified as a return of capital.
Unpack return of capital. Does that literally mean the MLP is just handing you your own initial investment back?
For tax accounting purposes, yes. Because it is deemed a return of your original principal, it is not immediately taxable as current income. Instead, the distribution mathematically lowers your cost basis in the MLP investment. You defer the tax liability until you eventually sell your shares in the MLP. At that future date, your capital gain will be significantly larger because your basis has been continually adjusted downward by those distributions.
It is a massive deferral mechanism. Return of capital equals basis reduction. Okay, let's pivot to the most complex entity structure-tested trusts and estates. Wealthy Wendy decides she wants to put a massive chunk of her portfolio into a standard complex trust for the eventual benefit of Careless Carl. How does the IRS tax a trust?
A trust is legally a separate taxable entity, complete with its own tax identification number. It is required to file its own annual tax return. The taxation mechanics depend entirely on what the trustee decides to do with the income generated by the trust's assets. Let's say the trust portfolio generates $50,000 in dividend and interest income this year. If the trustee distributes that $50,000 directly out to Carl, the trust takes a deduction and pays zero tax on that money. The income passes through to Carl, and Carl pays the tax at his own personal individual bracket.
Okay, that makes sense. It acts like a pass-through if the money moves. But what if Wendy designed the trust specifically so Carl cannot access the funds yet? What if the trust retains that $50,000 of income inside its own accounts?
If the trust retains the income, the trust itself becomes the taxpayer. And this brings us to one of the most critical structural traps in the entire tax section, the compression problem.
Yes. Let's talk about the compression trap, because this is where advisors really earn their fees.
In Section 1, we established that an individual taxpayer doesn't hit the maximum 37% tax bracket until they are earning hundreds of thousands of dollars, well over $600,000 for a single filer. Their water buckets are huge.
Right. It takes a massive amount of income to reach the top bracket.
Trust tax brackets, however, are violently compressed. A trust hits that maximum 37% tax rate at merely roughly $16,000 of retained taxable income.
$16,000. That is not a bucket, that is a thimble.
Yeah.
So if the trust retains that $50,000 of income, the vast majority of it is being taxed at the absolute highest possible federal rate. Why would Congress design a system that punishes trusts so severely?
It was a deliberate legislative strike against tax evasion. Historically, ultra-wealthy families would set up dozens of separate trusts and artificially park their income inside them, utilizing the lower tax brackets of each individual trust to shield their wealth. To destroy this loophole, Congress compressed the trust tax bracket so aggressively that it mathematically removes any incentive to hoard income inside a trust purely for tax avoidance.
So if you are an advisor reviewing a client's trust documents and you see a trust that is consistently retaining income and getting absolutely decimated by that 37% rate year after year, what is your strategic recommendation?
The strategy is to utilize the income distribution deduction. You advise the trustee to distribute the income out to the beneficiary. If you push the income out of the trust's compressed brackets and into Careless Carl's hands, the tax liability shifts to Carl, because Carl is likely sitting in a much lower individual tax bracket, perhaps the 12% or 22% bucket. The aggregate tax paid to the government on that same $50,000 is drastically reduced.
You distribute the income to save the wealth. That is brilliant. Unless, of course, the trust is structured as a grantor trust. Just define that exception really quickly before we move on.
A grantor trust is a specific arrangement where the person who created and funded the trust, the grantor, Wendy, retains so much control or direct benefit over the trust assets that the IRS simply ignores the trust's existence for income tax purposes. The trust is essentially transparent. All the income, whether retained or distributed, simply flows through and is reported directly on Wendy's personal 1040 tax return.
The IRS looks right through it. Okay, we have arrived at the grand finale. Section 6, wealth transfer and basis planning, death and taxes. Wealthy Wendy finally passes away, leaving her vast empire behind. The ultimate unavoidable tax event. How much of her fortune does the government actually get to seize?
This is the domain of the federal estate tax and the gift tax. The foundational concept here is that the United States government taxes the transfer of wealth, whether you attempt to transfer it while you are breathing via the gift tax or after your heart stops via the estate tax. However, Congress grants every citizen a very large statutory exemption before that taxation begins.
Let's talk about the big numbers. We're looking at 2026 figures, as that is the standard target for the current exam cycle. What is the baseline estate exemption amount?
The per-person lifetime exemption is $15 million.
$15 million. So if Wendy's total global estate is valued at $13 million on the day she dies, how much estate tax does her family owe?
Precisely zero. Her entire estate is fully sheltered by the exemption.
Okay, what if her estate is valued at $20 million?
The first $15 million is completely sheltered. The remaining $5 million is exposed and subject to the estate tax. And the top marginal rate on that excess is a staggering 40%.
40% of $5 million. That is a $2 million tax bill due to the government. That is serious wealth destruction.
Okay, so that is the math at death. But what about while she is still alive? Let's say Wendy wants to give Careless Carl some money right now so he can attempt to buy a house. What are the rules restricting gifts?
This introduces the annual gift tax exclusion.
Mm.
Wendy is allowed to give up to $19,000 per calendar year to an unlimited number of individual recipients, completely tax-free. She does not even have to file a form or report it to the IRS. If she wants to write a $19,000 check to Carl, a $19,000 check to Frank, and a $19,000 check to you, she can do that every single year.
What if Wendy is married? Does her husband get an exclusion too?
Yes, and married couples can practice a technique called gift splitting. They can legally combine their individual annual exclusions. Together, Wendy and her husband could give Carl $38,000 in a single calendar year without triggering any tax consequences or reporting requirements. Okay, but let's escalate this. Let's say Wendy wants to give Carl $1 million today. That is massively above the $19,000 annual exclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Does she have to write a check to the IRS for 40% of that $1 million right now?
No, she does not. And this is a very common point of confusion for candidates. The gift tax system and the estate tax system are inextricably linked. They are a single unified framework.
Okay, let's use a new analogy here. I'm throwing out the buckets. Think of the $15 million lifetime exemption, like a prepaid tax debit card issued by the IRS. Wendy has a card loaded with a $15 million balance. This balance represents her lifetime shelter. Every single time she gives a gift that is larger than the $19,000 annual limit, the excess amount is charged against her prepaid card. If she gives Carl $1 million this year, she doesn't owe cash tax today. She simply files a gift tax return, and the IRS deducts $1 million from her card's balance. Now, her card only has $14 million of shelter remaining for the future or for when she dies.
That is an excellent way to visualize the unified credit. Taxable gifts made during your lifetime permanently reduce the estate tax exemption available at your death, dollar for dollar. Whatever balance remains on that prepaid card when she dies is what is left to shelter her final estate.
Now we have to talk about the absolute most heartbreaking, devastating scenario in this entire section. It involves a concept called portability and the DSUE. Let's set the stage. Wendy was married. Her husband passed away a few years ago. Let's assume his total estate was only worth $2 million. He had his own $15 million prepaid debit card, but his estate only needed to use $2 million of it. What happened to the remaining $13 million of shelter on his card? Does the IRS just cancel it?
No. Thanks to a relatively recent legislative change called portability, a surviving spouse is legally allowed to inherit the deceased spouse's unused exemption. This transferable balance is formally called the Deceased Spousal Unused Exemption, or DSUE. So Wendy can legally take her late husband's leftover $13 million balance and add it directly to her own $15 million card, giving her a massive combined $28 million of total estate tax shelter.
That is incredible flexibility. A married couple can theoretically shelter up to $30 million total. But hair T, and here comes careless Carl. Let's say Carl was appointed as the executor of Wendy's husband's estate when he passed. Carl, in his infinite wisdom, looked at the husband's $2 million estate and concluded, well, $2 million is way under the $15 million limit. Obviously, we don't owe any tax, therefore I don't need to waste time filing any complicated, expensive estate tax paperwork with the IRS. What is the ultimate consequence of Carl's assumption?
The consequence is catastrophic for the family's wealth. Portability is not an automatic default rate. In order for Wendy to legally claim her late husband's unused exemption, the executor of the estate, Carl, must actively file a federal estate tax return, which is Form 706 for the deceased husband. He is required to file it even if absolutely zero tax is owed, purely to elect the portability option and establish the DSUE amount on the official IRS record.
And if Carl failed to file Form 706 because he thought it was unnecessary?
If Form 706 is not filed within the statutory time frame, the portability election is forfeited. The DSUE is permanently destroyed. Wendy's husband's remaining $13 million exemption simply evaporates into thin air. When Wendy eventually dies, her estate will only have her individual $15 million exemption to rely on, potentially exposing millions of dollars of her wealth to that 40% tax rate. Carl's failure to file a piece of paper could literally cost the family millions.
Listener, burn that into your memory. Portability demands Form 706, even for small estates. If you don't file, you lose the shelter. All right, we are down to the wire. Let's tackle the ultimate exam scenario, the scenario that defines whether you actually understand how to advise a client. It is basis planning. This directly compares the mathematical outcome of gifting a highly appreciated asset versus inheriting that same asset.
This is arguably the most practical, real-world piece of tax advice an investment advisor provides to an older, wealthy client.
Direct question for you, listener. I want you to think through the math. Wendy bought a block of tech stock decades ago. Her original purchase price was $10 a share. It has exploded in value over the years. Today, it is worth $100 a share. That means there is $90 of embedded untaxed capital gain sitting inside every single share. The critical question is, should Wendy gift this stock to careless Carl while she is still alive today, or should she hold on to it and let him inherit it when she dies? Which is better for Carl's ultimate wealth? Pause. Think about it. Okay, break the mechanics down for us.
Let's analyze the lifetime gift scenario first. If Wendy decides to gift the stock to Carl while she is alive, Carl receives what the tax code calls a carryover basis. He literally inherits her original historical cost. Carl's basis becomes $10.
Meaning that $90 of embedded gain is fully preserved and transferred. If Carl takes that gifted stock and sells it the very next day for $100, he must recognize and pay capital gains tax on that $90 profit. The tax liability is passed directly to him.
Correct. Now let's examine the inheritance scenario. If Wendy retains that stock in her portfolio until the day she dies and Carl inherits it through her estate, the tax rules undergo a radical transformation. Carl receives what is called a stepped-up basis.
Stepped up to what value?
Stepped up to the exact fair market value of the asset on the date of her death. If the stock is trading at $100 on the day she passes, Carl's new legal cost basis is $100.
Wait, what exactly happens to the $90 of embedded gain that Wendy built up over 30 years?
It is entirely permanently eliminated. It vanishes from the tax record. The tax meter resets to zero. If Carl sells the inherited stock the very next day for $100, his basis is $100, his proceeds are $100, and his taxable capital gain is mathematically zero. He pays absolutely no capital gains tax.
That is the staggering power of the step-up in basis. From a pure tax efficiency perspective, when dealing with highly appreciated assets, it is almost always mathematically superior to hold them until death rather than gifting them away during life.
Exactly. We have a simple foolproof mnemonic to remember this distinction for the exam.
Yes. Write this down. G equals G and D equals D. G for gift equals grandfather the basis. The historical basis carries over. D for death equals delete the gain. The basis steps up, erasing the historical gain. If the exam question asks you how to eliminate capital gains on an appreciated asset, the answer always involves holding for inheritance, not executing a lifetime gift.
There is, however, a third strategic option we must discuss. What if Wendy doesn't actually want to give this specific stock to Carl? What if she is charitably inclined and wants to donate that $100 stock to a qualified nonprofit organization?
Oh, the ultimate triple win. Explain the charitable alternative.
If you donate a highly appreciated security, assuming you have held it for more than 1 year to qualify for long-term status to a qualified public charity, three incredibly powerful tax benefits occur simultaneously. First, Wendy is allowed to deduct the full $100 fair market value of the stock on her current year income tax return, subject to certain AGI limits. Second, Wendy pays zero capital gains tax on the $90 of embedded appreciation. She never recognizes the gain. And third, because the charity is a tax-exempt entity, when they receive the stock and immediately sell it to fund their operations, they pay zero tax as well.
The embedded gain is wiped out completely, the charity receives the full maximum value of the asset, and Wendy gets a massive deduction against her ordinary income. If her primary goal is philanthropic, this strategy absolutely destroys both gifting to Carl and holding until death.
Correct. The exam will repeatedly test your ability to recognize that donating appreciated securities directly to a charity is vastly superior to the alternative, which is selling the securities yourself, paying the capital gains tax out of the proceeds, and then donating the remaining diminished cash balance.
Always transfer the shares directly. Do not liquidate them first. Okay, we have covered a staggering, immense amount of ground today. It is time for the outro. Let's lock this knowledge in. We are doing a rapid-fire recap of the absolute most testable takeaways from this entire deep dive. I'll take one, you take one. Go.
Long-term versus short-term capital gains rates. Holding an asset for 1 year or exactly less is short-term, taxed at brutal ordinary income rates. Holding for more than 1 year, a year, and a day unlocks long-term preferential rates of 0, 15, or 20%.
The $3,000 net capital loss limit. Remember the trap. This limit only applies when you are attempting to offset your ordinary income, like your W-2 salary. Capital losses offset capital gains dollar for dollar with infinite capacity, and any unused net losses carry forward indefinitely into future years.
The wash sale rule. If you sell at a loss and buy a substantially identical security within 30 days before or after, the loss is disallowed. Crucially, it is not permanently lost. It is deferred by being added to the cost basis of the newly purchased replacement shares.
REIT dividends. Real estate investment trusts sound like fancy corporate equities, but because they avoid corporate taxation, their dividends are taxed as ordinary income, not qualified dividends. Do not fall for the trap.
Basis planning. Inherited assets receive a step up in basis to fair market value at the date of death, completely eliminating embedded capital gains. Gifted assets receive a carryover basis, preserving the embedded gains. Remember, death equals delete, gift equals grandfather.
Trust taxation and the compression problem. Trust tax brackets are violently compressed to prevent tax hoarding. They hit the maximum 37% bracket at roughly $16,000 of retained income. The primary advisor strategy is to utilize the distribution deduction by pushing that income out to beneficiaries who reside in lower tax brackets.
And finally, portability and the DSUE. A surviving spouse can legally utilize their deceased spouse's unused estate tax exemption, but only if the executor actively files Form 706. If that return is not filed, the deceased's remaining exemption is lost forever.
Nailed every single one. Now, as we wrap up, we promise to leave you with a provocative final thought, something to chew on as you study these rigid rules. We spent a significant amount of time analyzing Wealthy Wendy and that massive $15 million estate exemption target for 2026.
We did. But tax laws are not etched in stone. They are entirely dependent on the whims of Congress. And many of the current tax laws, including that historically massive $15 million exemption, have strict sunset provisions built directly into their legislation.
Right. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act temporarily doubled that exemption amount. But that specific provision is statutorily set to expire.
Exactly. So here is the real-world strategic stumper for you. What happens to Wealthy Wendy's carefully crafted multi-million dollar estate plan if a gridlocked Congress does absolutely nothing and allows that sunset provision to trigger at midnight on December 31st? Overnight, automatically, that $15 million exemption drops back down to roughly $5 million, adjusted for inflation.
Two-thirds of her tax shelter instantly vaporized while she sleeps.
How incredibly nimble does an advisor actually have to be to protect a family's lifetime of wealth when the fundamental underlying rules of the game can change drastically overnight without a single new law being passed?
It means this job is never static. You cannot just build a plan, set it, and forget it. You have to constantly be reviewing, forecasting, and adapting. The U.S. tax code is a living, breathing, terrifying monster, and your job is to tame it for your clients. Take a deep breath, listener. Review these concepts. Visualize Frank struggling with double taxation, Carl panicking over his wash sales, and Wendy navigating her prepaid exemption card. You understand the why behind the rules now. Go dominate this section of the exam. You've completely got this.